Hey, all you improvisers, let's start the year off right with my intro to the Artist Low Comedy Virtual Workshop. I'm offering it Saturday, January 15th, online. So if you've always wanted to work with me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy improv method, now is your chance. And if you sign up by January 1st, this workshop is only $69. To register or for more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. And if you feel stuck or in a rut improvising two-person scenes and you just need a little inspiration, maybe you need a little direction that you haven't been able to get lately, then I want to let you know that I will be offering an in-person two-person scene tune-up on Saturday, December 31st, right here in Chicago. For more information or to register, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jimmy Corain, and I'm the host of Improv Nerd, and you are tuning in to another great episode. Our guest today is Dan O'Connor. He is an actor, teacher, improviser, and author. His new book is Ensemble, Using the Power of Improv and Play to Forge Connections in a Lonely World. He co-wrote that book with Jeff Katzman. We talked to Dan in this episode about what it was like to work with Keith Johnstone and what he learned from him. Also, how to bring more vulnerability into your improv. And of course, we talked to him about his new book. Before we get to the episode with Dan, I just want to let you know that I'm a little stressed out because of Christmas. Last year, it was really easy. It was the beginning of the pandemic and nobody was getting together for Christmas, so we didn't have to go to Pennsylvania to see Lauren's parents, and I didn't have to see my mom, who lives here in Chicago. We just got together with one couple that we're really close with and their kids, and we just went in their backyard and exchanged presents around a bonfire. Well, this year, it's like we've got a lot more parties to go to, and Betsy understands Santa Claus and that Santa Claus brings presents. And of course, she wants more things and she's more specific in what she wants because she's now 5 years old. So I'm just feeling a lot of stress during the holidays, which I always try to avoid, but it never seems to work. Okay, enough about me. Here is the Dan O'Connor episode. And I just want to let you know, I can't remember doing an episode of the podcast where someone talked this extensively about Keith Johnstone and his work, and I just found it very fascinating. So I think you're going to enjoy it. Dan is a very thoughtful, he's very articulate about improvisation, and he also brings a very strong acting background to it. So I know you're going to like this. I know you're going to learn a lot from it. Here it is, the Dan O'Connor episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Dan O'Connor, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy.
So let's start. I mean, you were like, you studied theater in London. You were like a very serious actor. You still are. People know. How does it, because I'm always amazed, like, people that start as serious actors and then they fall in love with improv. Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, I was a child actor at the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. So at age 8 or 9, I started going to acting school because there were after school programs they had a thing called the Young Conservatory. And I was doing improv at 9 and 10 because they would, you know, 9 and 10 year olds don't have a great facility for a lot of memorization. So we studied Commedia dell'arte, and we did do some scripted stuff. But I got into comedy. Like one of the exercises, which is an improv exercise that I've done as an adult. They took us all to a museum and had us pick out a painting and then do a scene about it, improvise a scene about it, or write a scene about it. So early on, I was drawn to it. And I was an actor. I wasn't a comedic actor. I wasn't a serious dramatic actor. I started getting cast in plays across the street at the big theater, and I got my equity card when I was 12 or something like that. So when I went off to London, I had been doing comedy and been doing improv, but not that wasn't my whole thing. I was a serious actor in that I really wanted to study how the English did things. I fancied myself a classical actor, and I wanted to be classically trained. In fact, they tried to kick me out about a year in because they didn't want Americans to stay because they were afraid that they would try and get work. But improv saved my college career because we were doing a restoration play, The Recruiting Officer by George Fuqua, and I was playing the sort of alpha character, Captain Plume, and there's the love interest and the fop are supposed to enter, and I'm waiting for them to enter, and she had thought we were in the second act and had gone up to change, and so the fop is on the side in the wings looking at me panicked. I don't know where she is. Anyway, I had to improvise for about a minute 20 in restoration English while someone ran to the dressing rooms and grabbed her. And the next day, you know, the way drama school works is you have a speech teacher, you have a text teacher, you have an acting teacher, you have a voice teacher. So all during the day in all of my classes, they were going, great job. And I was able to stay. They didn't kick me out. So improv saved my college career.
So then from there, you start doing a short form theater sports and you study with Keith Johnstone. What was it about Keith's approach to theater sports at that point was short form games? What was Johnstone's approach to short form games?
Johnstone's approach was very very zen in that it was about not trying to be funny. Underline trying. His approach and his approach still is about being average. The more obvious you are, the more original. You know. Basically trying to get improvisers to get out of their head and stop trying to be clever. And it was, and I really took to it instantly. I when I started doing it in San Francisco, it made sense on so many levels. And I was really lucky because I was one of the younger, when I started doing it, I was 22 or 23. And most of the other improvisers were pro comics and actors from all over the Bay Area who were, you know, 10, 15, 20 years older than me. So it was kind of like, you know, going to the Shaolin Temple and learning from the masters. From as far as Johnstone goes, his approach was so amazingly simple. I kept sort of going, it can't possibly be this simple, but it was. And it really made things, digestible is the word that comes to mind. Do you know what I mean?
When you think of short form, you think about getting to the laugh very quickly. And Johnstone's approach almost is not, but I would imagine that there was laughs there.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things that I gleaned out of doing that work for so long was the real comedy is getting, even if you're doing short form, and, you know, we had very dramatic conversations about short form versus long form back in the day. But even if you're doing short form, there's still story there. Johnstone's thing was there's still story and there's still something you can give to the audience. And the real belly laughs, the real sort of woof, as he used to say, from the audience when they're laughing as one organism comes from narrative laughs. So if you're getting a laugh because of narrative, then that's a much more satisfying laugh than doing an improviser thing where you're making your friend in the fifth row laugh because he's in class with you. So he drew a big distinction between gags and I guess narrative laughter, for lack of a better term. So we learned early on, don't just go for the gag. That was one of the reasons why theater sports used to have the bag. The bag was for any sexist, racist, gratuitous jokes. So if you gagged offensively, you could get bagged and you'd have to wear the bag on in the next scene for a minute or something like that. But the real reason...
You really had to put a bag on your...
There was a paper bag or a basket. Canadians, I think, have baskets. Americans,
they're gentler people. They're gentler people, yes.
But a lot of people initially, when they heard that, especially if they were learning theater sports second or third hand and not from Johnstone, thought it was a censorship tool. And it's not. It's a tool to... get you to be a little bit more deep with your improv and not just go for dick jokes. So that was in place. There were a number of other Johnstonian things that were in place with original theater sports to make it more narrative, more engaged with the audience, and not just what we think of as short form, faster, funnier.
So when you say you're deriving the laugh from the narrative versus the gag, can you give us an example of getting a laugh from the narrative?
So if he has an exercise, maybe this will explain, I don't know. He has a very, very basic exercise, which I've got it from him. I've probably had this same class 30 times, which is what comes next, which is one of his basic exercises in class, which is you sit in a chair and then the rest of class, you say, what comes first? And somebody says, you open the drawer in front of you. Then you say, what comes next? Somebody says, you pull out a gun. What comes next? You shoot yourself in the head.
So then we take him to the hospital.
Right. But so what Johnstone said, like the example that I use is if what comes first? You open the drawer in front of you. What comes next? You suddenly see aliens at the window. What comes next? They come in and they abduct you. So that may be funny. Let's just pretend it is for a second. What Johnstone would say is, what comes first? You open the drawer in front of you. What comes next? You pull out a hairbrush or a letter or whatever. What comes next? You hear a sound in the distance. What comes next? You turn to the window. What comes next? You see the curtains flapping in the wind. What comes next? The window suddenly flies open. What comes next? There's a bright light outside. So in other words, he would say that you need to provide for the audience the context in which the comedy is delivered. If you just go straight to the gag, people may laugh at it, but it's not resonant, and they're not going to talk about it in the car on the way home or on the bus on the way home. So what I mean by that is let's learn about the character that Jimmy's playing, let's find out who he is. And then when shit happens to him, we relate to it. We understand it, as opposed to he gets a pie in the face. That's funny, but we don't know who you are. So there's a relatability, there's an understanding, there's a resonance with regard to what the story is. And you know, I'm sure from talking and teaching improv for so long, that good narrative creates oxytocin in the brain. Good stories actually make you feel good, as opposed to a lot of barprov or glibprov, where you're not really engaged, you're just laughing at, as opposed to laughing with, because now you're engaged. And, you know, a real good night of improvisation, the audience feels like they're part of the show as opposed to observers or just audience members.
Which is interesting because you are the artistic director at Improv Theater in Los Angeles since 2003.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've recently stepped down, just for clarification. Okay,
great. Well, we've got an exclusive here. Is it? How do you, for people who are listening, how do you make the audience feel like this, they're coming to an event, really? And it's, we're gonna share this night together.
I think not talking down to them. I mean, I'm sure you've seen groups that the audience is almost secondary. They're just there to get their to get off, and that's it. And so, in a Johnstone sense, Johnstone always likes to have the show start slow with a real like. The audience almost asking, dear God, are these guys going to be able to improvise? And then as stuff goes better, the audience is surprised. So that's a Johnstonian way of looking at
it. Was it almost like, let's not worry about the laughs up top?
Yeah.
Is that the foundation?
Yeah. I would say we talk about core or crow. This is not a Johnstone thing. I'm not sure who came up with it, but it's been a tenant of our company and the company up in San Francisco forever, which is character, objective, relationship, environment, or character, relationship, objective, where the idea that rather than
stand for those things, right?
Yeah.
C-O-R-E.
Okay. Core, character, objective, relationship, environment, or character, relationship, objective, where core or crow, it's six in one. But the idea that we need to know who the people are on stage are so that we know who to root for, so that we know what we're watching, as opposed to a lot of improv, which is two characters in a Samuel Beckett-esque wasteland, seemingly not vulnerable to us. And so we want to know what we're watching. And it's not like it takes 5 minutes to establish story. You can establish good story in one line. But so often, I was in a bar prog group at the Laugh Factory for 9 years. So I mean, there's nothing wrong with bar prov. It's just that when we started to do improv theater, we really wanted to be a theater company. We wanted to do unscripted plays. And that, you know, if you're improvising a 2-hour play, the audience has to be engaged and care about what happens. You can't just keep giving them jokes. They'll get tired. And they'll start to disconnect because they're not invested. So the ethic is to engage them in a narrative that they're going to want to watch to conclusion. And one of the reasons why we do Jane Austen and Shakespeare and Dickens and film noir is that there's an arc of narrative that can be exploited, and it gives us a world in which people understand it. And even if they don't understand it, I mean, I knew we were onto something early on when we had this girl bring her boyfriend to a Jane Austen unscripted show. And the dude was a complete frat boy. I don't think he'd ever seen Jane Austen or read about Jane Austen, but afterwards, he had a great time. He understood the story. He was like, dude, that was really amazing, you know? So we were able to create good story that it didn't matter if somebody didn't know about Anton Chekhov or whatever it is. Good story is good story. So
when you do genre improv like you guys do, because I think for me, I'm intimidated by it. What are the similarities between that and doing just a regular long form, like say a Harold or a montage?
Well, with a Harold or a montage, you can sort of, in my opinion, you're riffing off of whatever the monologues were in the front, and there's you can go off on tangents, what have you. You don't necessarily have to remain a character for 2 hours or 90 minutes or whatever it is. Which is great. That form of improv is terrific. I think we had all experienced multiple types of improv and really wanted to use the skills we learned in drama school to apply to the work we were doing as improvisers. And, the original company members all were professional actors, you know, and they did do comedy and they did do drama. When we started doing Shakespeare, we just found it to be, it was very intimidating, but we were used to, just to back up, we were used to doing short form genre stuff, like somebody say, do a scene in the style of Tennessee Williams. And so we'd mention bourbon, humidity, and mendacity. It was always the same thing. There wasn't any substance to it. So in the late 90s, we started going, well, let's rehearse this stuff. Let's read some Shakespeare together. Let's learn how to improvise a sonnet. Let's figure out what the difference is between blank verse and rhyming verse. And got to a place where, just like jazz, we learned the saxophone, we practiced the scales, and then we'd go and do the genre. And sometimes people would screw up in the genre, but we just made it part of the thing. We tried not to, and we still try not to make modern day references inside of it. But different strokes for different folks. I think the group that improvises Austin at Edinburgh and in the West End, Ostentatious, I think they're much more witty and clever and do incorporate modern referencing. At least that's what I know secondhand, so I may be wrong about that, but I know they're really talented. But whereas when we do Jane Austen, we're really trying to do something that if Jane Austen was sitting in the audience, she would recognize as being of her world. So that's one of the reasons why we chose literary genres, is it was something that we could really study, and then do something that that person never wrote.
And in terms of commercially, I've found that for whatever reason, and I'd love to know what you think, a genre improv in terms of a mainstream audience, it seems to be more appealing.
I think so. A lot of times we get folks who have no idea, they've never seen improv before, but they know Jane Austen or they know film noir. So it's our way of looping in audience members who haven't experienced improv before. I think that's probably true, but all the Whose Line guys, they don't need to frame it in anything because they have a television show, so they're able to do that. Though some of my favorite stuff from the English Whose Line were the genre pieces. Anyway, I think people also, we're doing sets and props and costumes. We did noir with a 5-piece jazz ensemble doing the score. Our music director, Peter Smith, at the time, was looking at that those sort of big 40s and 50s film scores as a place to be inspired. We have each of the shows has its own production, so that if you didn't know better, and this has happened before, some people come to the show and think that they saw a written play,
Which I think is the biggest compliment.
It's very interesting. And we realize we don't have to prove that we're improvising. We know we're improvising. If people are entertained, it doesn't matter, I've gotten into very heated conversations with people after Jane Austen because they're trying to find the format. They're trying to find the pre-planned stuff. And I go, well, what about this and what about that? And you can see the penny drop where they realize, oh shit, there's no way they could have pre-planned this. And that's one of my favorite. We had two terrific reviews, but in both of them, this was early on, it's like 2004 or something, or 2006, but in both the reviewers, and they were local LA reviewers, they were saying, obviously some of this stuff is pre-planned. And I wrote to both guys and I said, look, that's fine. Thank you so much for enjoying the show, but it's not pre-planned. Come back tomorrow night on me. Come see the show. One of the guys didn't. He never responded. The other guy did, and he wrote another review because it was proven to him that there was no format. And so there are moments like that where I really wanted to make sure that people understand that we're not going off of any template, that we're actually improvising a narrative right in front of them, and they're part of watching the play be created.
So let's talk about your book Ensemble, Using the Power of Improv and Play to Forge Connections in a Lonely World. You co-wrote this with Jeff Katzman, I think it's a very interesting book in terms of you make this argument, I think, in the book that the world has become a much more lonely place and improv could help us.
Yes. And I mean, I'm a firm believer, and so is Jeff. And Jeff is a psychiatrist who improvises occasionally. But we're both firm believers, and I know there's a lot of people, especially in the applied improv world, who believe that improv is a power for good in the world. That if everybody on the planet treated each other like an improv partner, that we'd be in a much more harmonious, engaged place. Hence the title of the book, Ensemble. And Jeff came up with the idea of using ensemble as a verb, you know, to ensemble, because we began seeing like this. We started writing the book before the pandemic. We I think like 2 or 3 weeks before the pandemic, and then we finished it, obviously during the pandemic. But we were shocked when Theresa May, who was the prime minister before Boris Johnson in the UK, appointed a minister for loneliness. That the loneliness had become such a issue in the UK that they wanted to address it on a cabinet level secretary because it was such a problem. And you would think in such an interconnected digital world that loneliness would be less of a problem, but it's actually more of a problem. And we feel that, you know, a Johnstone thing, one of the first things that Johnstone ever taught any of us was make your partner look good. And if I'm on stage with you and I'm just focusing on serving you and making you look good, it takes the anxiety off of me. I don't have that stage fright of, you know, how am I coming off? Am I witty or clever? I'm just helping Jimmy. That very small example is sort of was very inspiring to us in terms of how improv applied in real life works. That if you listen better, you're more engaged with the other person, you make more positive choices. I think the act of listening part is huge. You know, if you think about people who are in, think about your close relationships, whether it's with a partner or with a member of your work ensemble or your family ensemble. You being a good listener is half the battle with regards to how resonant and how productive that relationship is. So we wrote the first book, Life Unscripted, about 5 years ago, which was about getting off the scripts that your family may have laid on you or other people may have put on you and living a more authentic life using improv skills. And Ensemble just seemed to be the next logical way of moving forward, which is how do you, in a time when people are so lonely, how do you engage with other people? What makes your relationships more solid, more strong? Also, how do you recognize when you're in an ensemble that is unhealthy? You know, when you have a friend group that is not supporting you and making you look good, they're not serving the narrative of your life.
So what do you say? Because this happens a lot. I've been in groups or I've coached groups where it isn't a good fit. How do you handle that?
I've just tried to talk about why are we here? If I'm teaching and occasionally, I've been really lucky. I haven't had a class go south for a while, but we got to a point, this is years ago, this is the late 90s, there was a class that we had that nobody could teach. They just were unhappy. And
were unhappy.
The students were unhappy.
They couldn't be satisfied.
Right. And we had, I think in the end, we had four, maybe five different teachers take a shot at trying to engage with them. And we finally got to the place where we did, we basically broke up the class and, offered people different places to go inside of the school and things like that. But they had just formed this sort of calcified negative tribe. And it's nobody's fault. It just that was the case, but we needed to recognize, and I think now if that were to happen, we might recognize that a little bit sooner. But we do point out in ensemble, there are things to look for. Are you being supported? Are you engaged? Are you happy being part of this group? Maybe you shouldn't be in this group. Now, when it comes down to family, you don't have a choice about being in that group. But you can be a better listener. You can be more positive. You can be less confrontational. There's any number of things that you can do in order to make that ensemble better.
So there was a couple things in the book that I'd like to discuss that I think
Sure.
really apply to improv. And one is you talk about slowing down in your improv. Why do you find that to be important?
Well, it goes back to the relationship with the audience. I know I have, I'm sure you have been in shows and seen shows where people are moving so fast to get to a joke that the joke doesn't land because, once again, it hasn't been provided for, or it's out of context, or we don't know who you are yet, so why do we care that you threw the pie, whatever it is. Improvisers, I'm generalizing, improvisers sometimes get to a place where they're like just trying to get to the next joke. And so while they're thinking about the next joke, they're not listening to what you just said. So it starts to form a disconnect, and the audience can feel that disconnect. The audience, like Lenny Bruce said, individually they may be idiots, but as a whole, they're genius. And I think Johnstone would hold that truth as well. So we have been trying to slow down so that the audience can understand what's happening and relate to what's happening in a more deeper way. The time on stage and time in the audience is very different. Improvisers think, oh, we got to get to the joke, or we can't have any pauses. Silence is bad. Whereas the audience, if you're committed to the choices you're making, we can have silence. A lot of stuff can be filled in by the audience in that silence. If I say something to you in the scene and we're both quiet, but we're both present in the scene, the audience is going, oh, what's Jimmy going to say? Did Dan offend him? Did Dan compliment him? Whatever it is. But they're engaged in the story. Whereas if I'm not leaving any space and I'm, just picking up the cues after everything you say, there's no time for the story to breathe. There's no time for the audience to grab a hold of something. Yeah, there's an old gibberish short form game called Chain Murder where the audience gives one person, three other people on the team are plugging their ears and they can't hear. But the audience gives you a room, an occupation, and an object. And then the clock starts, and in 3 minutes, you've got to endow the second person with knowing that they're in the living room, they're a dentist, and they kill you with a toothpick. And then they have to do it to the next person, they have to do it to the last person. So beginning improvisers just are all they're thinking about is the time. They're just trying to rush through stuff. So what happens is the person who's receiving the gibberish clues hasn't got a clue because they're going too fast. Whereas if you take your time, they may try different things, and you may open up a space where, comedy can happen, story can happen, what have you. Who cares that you don't get done by the 3 minutes? That's an artificial thing just to give the scene some energy from the audience. The scene is really about making mistakes. But if we don't know what you're doing, we don't care. So, Yeah, I'm trying to think. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, yes. And then the other thing you talk about in your book, which is vulnerability. You say in life it's very important, but it's also important on stage. How do you get your students to be more vulnerable in their improv?
Well, we go back to narrative and talk about if you're just phoning it in, and once again, you and I have both been in shows and seen shows where there's no vulnerability on stage. It's just people trying to be funny, but we're not really seeing them. They're not being vulnerable. They're just being funny. And, you know, there's a place for that improv in the world too. But for our improv ethic, we want to see you be changed. That's a John Stone thing from way back. A sort of core value is the audience wants to see the actor changed. Actors can do things, or improvisers can do things, that real folks, audience members, can never dream of doing. So if you say something to me and I'm not changed by it, there's not really anything for them to relate to or wonder about. Whereas if I'm changed by the information, if my status is altered, my emotional life is altered, if I'm changed by it, then it creates a question in the mind of the audience. Will he confess that he's been having an affair with his wife? Will the, you know, the, whatever the question is of the story will be in the mind of the audience.
And that occurs in one line. Like if we did a scene, I'm like, are you sleeping with Carol?
Yeah. Well, Bob, you know, it, yeah.
I'm sleeping with her. I can tell by the way you're reacting. You didn't answer me.
It's been going on for 2 years.
Oh, I knew it.
But it was just my way to get closer to you. Bob, I'm wondering what you think about a throuple.
The three of us?
Yes.
I was waiting for you to ask.
See?
Okay. So, but so you're saying that it can happen, this change, which when people think change, oh my God, we're talking about a three-act structure and the character changes at the end. But you're saying this, so where was the change with you when I asked you that line?
Well, I mean, if you and I were in a noir, I might say, no, I'm not sleeping with her because I know I'm planning on killing you later in my mind, right. Planning on killing you. Now, I may never get to kill you because it's improv and we don't know what's going to happen. But the audience knows by my no that now the game's afoot. So I don't want to be literalist about it because I think especially like beginning students will go, you want me to change on every line? And I'm saying, no, you don't have to change on every line, but you have to be affected by what's being said to you. And sometimes what's being said to you is saying no, or is denying it from a narrative standpoint, not from an improvisational standpoint. So we can say no and get away from the fascism sometimes that yes and can be taught like.
But also what you did was you said no verbally, but it was very clear to me as a player that it was a yes.
And hopefully it's clear to the audience as well. And now we've got stakes. Now people are wondering if you're going to find out, if you're going to kill me, if I'm going to get away with it. If you and I are not changed by each other, then why, you know, why are we watching the scene?
And I think what you mean probably to simplify it and tell me if I'm wrong is to be affected by it, to be affected by what somebody says emotionally.
Yes. Yes. And that's where that's the core of vulnerability is if I'm just doing glib prov and, you know, looking to, and I'm sorry, that sounds demeaning. I don't mean it to be, but if I'm not being changed by you, it may be very funny, but we're not going to get anywhere narratively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like having candy, candy, candy. Sometimes you need to have something savory. You need to be changed. You need to see the audience see you be changed.
And I want to say to in that scenario, I made the choice of going with agreement. And the reason I went with agreement there was you had said something like, I did it because I wanted to get closer to you, which I thought was a really strong choice because you made it about our relationship. Because something like that could be like, we could be talking about my wife, right? And then I'm like, I'm going to agree with it because how you had set it up emotionally, you know, that, you know, if this is, I'm going to agree with wanting to be closer and going with that. Because if not, then we're in this thing about, did you, you know, I'm mad that you had the affair. And we certainly could go down that path and it might work, but that's why I made that choice.
So one of the things that I talk about, especially when we're talking about improvising a play, whether it's genre or not, is there are slice of life scenes that playwrights put in where we're getting to know the characters that Dan and Jimmy are playing. As improvisers who are also playwrights, we can't really have slice of life scenes because we don't know what's happening next. So in every scene that you and I are doing, we need to be going somewhere. And a lot of the time, improvisers will just do the same beat over and over for, you know, they'll repeat the same beat three times. I know you're sleeping with my wife. No, I'm not. I swear. It's, you know, you're just stressed from work. No, I know you're sleeping. So that goes back and forth a lot. Now, if one of us is slowly getting more and more angry or more and more guilty, then maybe that beat is changing. But if we're just playing the same emotional tone and we're not giving, we're not being vulnerable, then we're just repeating the beat. So we talk about try not to be slice of life. Try to think about what is the narrative beat? Okay, he's admitted having an affair with the guy's wife and he's invited him to a throuple. And he's interested. Okay, so we have three beats there. What's next? If they just go on about the gloriousness of the throuple, that eventually is going to get tiresome as well. So what is the next thing? She comes in, or the lights slowly fade as they climb into bed. You know, there's any number of things, but when we're teaching our techs who are improvisers, we're teaching them to look for the punctuation in a scene. So if they've seen something go on too long and recognize it, the audience has also recognized it. And so maybe they bring the music up, maybe the music swells, maybe the lights go down, maybe the woman improviser who's the wife comes in on the side and announces she's leaving with the first guy, who knows. But we're looking for the punctuation of each scene so we don't have these long, drawn out, repetitive slice of life scenes.
But I also think the choice of you saying, and I see this in class, the tendency is to get into a fight, right? You had an affair with what? Then you say, I did it, all right, to get closer. All right, which is a strong choice. I think it's a very funny choice. It's a comedic choice. It talks about the relationship, and more importantly, it avoids any sort of argument, right? Because you're saying this is why you did it. So I think a lot of times people don't get to that point, and that's how they get stuck in the when they're butting heads.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and it's one of the reasons why. Like doing Chekhov. Chekhov is my favorite genre to do because, and somebody once described this to me, Russians are feeling everything at all times. Mm-hmm. So you can be really angry in the first three, four words of the sentence and then fall into laughter with the last three or four words. And that, you know, an argument is not just an argument. An argument leads to something. There is a result of it. So what we're trying to do is not be repetitive. And that goes for characters as well. Like when we first started doing Tennessee Williams, one of our guys plays a good sort of big daddy, cruel, merciless Southerner. And he had done it for three or four shows, he'd done a version of that. And we were like, hey, don't, let's, you know, do something else. And the next show, he played this very effete artist who was leaving town so that he could be himself. And it was fantastic. But the point being is that everything should be completely original to that night of improv.
I want to ask you, also, you say in your book, and I think this is it's good for me to hear and people that are taking improv classes, that a good student is one that challenges the teacher.
That's a Johnstone thing. And I think it's really important. I like to think that, I mean, I don't know about you, but I learned so much from teaching. I get so much from it. And I think I used to, and I think I say this in the book, I used to believe that my job as a teacher was to come in and deliver the information. And over the years, that has evolved into, I'm here to share the information and see what the students think of it, or see how the students are able to apply it. And that has served me well, just in terms of the ensemble of that particular class, how we collaborate. I mean, if a student is just being an asshole, that's one thing. But if a student is genuinely challenging some of the principles or whatever I'm teaching, then it's an opportunity to go, okay, let's get you and you, and let's prove that on the laboratory that is the stage, rather than talking about it. I think in the early days, we talked a lot about theory and application and good long form versus short form and all this stuff, where really the thing to do, and this is what Johnstone used to do when he was working with the writers group at the Royal Court in the 60s, is they wanted a place where the writers could put stuff up and sort of prove it on stage, rather than talking it to death and rather than scheduling meetings. And we've tried to embrace that as well, in terms of, okay, let's not talk about it anymore. Let's see what happens when you do it, or let's see what happens when you don't do it. And to really be open to change, which is something I learned from Johnstone way, way back, is that he was teaching this class, and this is 15 years ago now, and he suddenly stopped and he went, oh, something I've been teaching for 10 years is totally wrong. And I just was so happy to hear that teachers evolve, that teachers aren't a fixed mindset, that there's a growth that's happening from year to year, from class to class.
So we got to wrap this up, and we always end the podcast with the same question. What one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
It's a two-parter. I would say, don't be an asshole. Improvisation is about collaboration, not domination. And even though you may be incredibly talented and funny, the sign of a good improviser is that people like playing with you. And so I would say be open, be vulnerable, which is the polite way of saying don't be an asshole, is be open, be vulnerable. Improvising can be very anxious. You can be very anxious. You can be filled with fear. But once you realize that making mistakes is half of the art form, I think it relaxes people a lot. And if you go in tense and wanting to control things, you're going to have challenges. So don't be an asshole. That's my advice.
Well, Dan O'Connor, I will take that to heart. Thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd. And there you have it, another great episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our guest, Dan O'Connor, and check out his book, Ensemble, Using the Power of Improv and Play to forge connections in a lonely world. I know you can get it on Amazon. I also want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Please check us out on all our social media platforms. Like us on Facebook, our fan page, Improv Nerd, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, Improv_Nerd. Go to our Patreon page. And also, if you want information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops and classes that are both in person and online, go to jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. I want to thank you for listening, and remember, walk, don't run.